This lecture is entitled Squatology and was presented by Paul Check at the Canadian Association of Fitness Professionals annual convention in Toronto, August 2003.
So our topic for this morning is one that I feel is quite important. It is squatology. It's a term I borrowed from the famous physical therapist, Gary Gray. I use that word squatology to mean the science of squatting without injuring. As I'm sure many of you know, a lot of people today are afraid of the squat. Even elite level bodybuilders won't do free squats. They'll only use a Smith machine. And I've asked many of them, I've rehabilitated many of them. I said, why don't you squat? Oh, every time I get heavy into squatting, I hurt my back. So they think it's the squat that's a problem. Well, it's almost always bad technique or bad periodization. Squat's a big exercise. It's a demanding exercise. If you're using heavy weights and you are not periodizing yourself properly, you'll get hurt doing any big lift, squat, deadlift, otherwise. Who was here at my lecture yesterday? Okay, so you'll remember some of the principles we talked about. If you apply that discussion yesterday to someone that squats heavy and too frequently, you know they're going to get hurt just by the pure catabolic nature of the exercise. Our objectives today are to learn to squat with optimal technique. We're going to challenge industry myths regarding squatting so I can earn another one of these. And we are going to explore a variety of squatting methods. Hopefully, I'll be able to show you some interesting and unique variations on the squat theme that you can apply to people once they have achieved a foundation level of conditioning. Later today in my scientific balance training program, I'll show you what it actually takes to build the body up so that you can take some of that information and apply it. All these lectures weave together, kind of like a story, and you need each of the pieces. They're not modular. In other words, this chunk here, that chunk there. You'll see that there's foundation themes throughout my lectures that build you up to a knowledge of understanding of how to progress people and show you how to use each given exercise for a specific person at a different level. The first thing I want you to have in your head is that squatting is a primal movement. We have had to squat to survive for as long as humanity has inhabited this planet. Period. There's no two ways about it. We've been squatting since the beginning of time. One of the primary things we had to do always was to build shelter. So squatting, as an example, would have been used to build shelter. Now, when it comes to who should squat, what I wanted to show you here is that if you look at the toilets, if you look at Singapore, Beijing, India, I could keep going, but the greatest percentage of the world population does not move their bowels in a half squat position like Americans and North Americans do, or even most Europeans. The majority of the world moves their bowel from a full squat position. And that is exactly how Mother Nature designed us. So the point that I'm making to you here is that most people in the world have to squat. How many of you have clients that say, I can't squat? Right? Lots of you. Well, I guarantee you, if those people were in most of these foreign countries, they wouldn't be saying, I can't squat. Or they'd be the most toxic, constipated, sick people in the world. Okay? This is a cool toilet. Look, you have your choice. If your knees are worn out from bad diet and bad exercise, you flip the lid down. That's how we know you need a good therapist. Or you can climb up there and it's got a nice spot for your feet. I want one of them. What I'll do is I'll hop onto it. Now, what you see here is that we have exercise certification agencies all over the world telling trainers and strength coaches that people should not squat below parallel, that it's bad for the knees. Ladies and gentlemen, do you actually think that the creative, intelligent force of the universe created a design flaw in your body? I mean, most of the world's population has to go into a full squat. And in a minute, I'm going to show you, if you don't go into a full squat, you cannot effectively move your bowel, which is very, very much one of the reasons why North Americans and a lot of Europeans, especially England, there's more constipation in England than anywhere, are constipated. Okay? But here you go. You will see in the Asian countries and in most countries, you'll see children and you'll see athletes and workers in full squats everywhere. If the environment demands a full squat, you either have to do a full squat. And if you can't, you're either going to have to change your job or go get rehabilitated. The problem is even in physical therapy, they believe this garbage. I've been in physical therapy. I've been in rehabilitation. I owned a physical therapy clinic for almost 4 years. I worked in the largest physical therapy clinic in San Diego for 4 years. I worked with a chiropractor for 2 years. I worked with an osteopath in the Army for 2 years. So I've got my own, plus my own clinical experience. I've been doing this 20 years, and there's not a single person I can recall that I was not able to rehabilitate to performing a full squat unless they had a frank orthopedic disorder, such as they had such severe degenerative changes in their knees that to have them do full squats was just detrimental. In other words, they had a disorder that I could not repair because it was damage, bone damage, or they've had multiple surgeries. Sometimes the surgeons do a patella realignment surgery and they screw the mechanics of the knee so bad with the surgery that I can't do any better for the patient. All I can do is make them as strong as I can. That's all I can do. But of all the thousands of people I've rehabilitated, I could probably count on my two hands the people that I could not get to comfortably do full squats again through proper diet and proper exercise. If you're not teaching people how to do full squats, basically you're leaving them with a functional deficit because we are designed to and need to and will end up doing full squats. Talk to any mother in this room that's got a child who she's had to dress in the morning. And down they go and put on the little girl's shirt or whatever, right? Keep that in mind. Now, what I want to do to begin with here that is rarely ever done in exercise or even healthcare conferences, because I lecture all over the world. I lecture in medical schools, chiropractic schools, physical therapy schools, strength and conditioning conferences, and massage therapy conferences. And I work in 11 countries. So I can tell you comfortably, this isn't talked about, and it needs to be talked about. So what I want to talk about first is how to improve physiology with the squat. Okay? We're going to look at basic health and functional strength, and then we're going to look at squatting for performance. Most of you are using the squat to improve performance on people that can't even have a bowel movement. Well, that would be like putting more horsepower in your car if the exhaust pipe was clogged up. What good would that do? Nothing. It'd just be a waste of time and money. So what I want you to know, and very few people realize this absolute anatomical fact, in the animal kingdom, human beings are the only animals that must push fecal material uphill. Did you know that? How many of you knew that? One of you, two of you maybe. Okay, well, here's what I want you to see. When the human being is standing up, that's the cecum, ascending colon, transverse colon, descending sigmoid rectum. Okay, appendix. Now, when you're standing up, once the small intestine moves the undigestible food particles and the remains out into the cecum here, it actually has to be pumped uphill. It has to be pumped all the way up from about right here, all the way up to about here, about a foot up. Then it goes across and down the left side. All you got to remember is that fecal material leaves on the left. That's my little way of remembering, leaves on the left, okay? If a human being does not do enough functional activity, what kind of exercises did I say in my lecture yesterday were the kind of exercise that would help improve fluid movement and pressure changes through the trunk? I gave them a name. Deformation exercises, deforming the torso. So what you see here is when somebody goes down into a full squat, the right thigh, if you just look as I go into a squat, I can't do it on stage. As I go into a squat and I completely relax, you guys all know what a squat looks like. The right thigh goes up and presses right into the cecum, squashes it. What's that going to do to the fecal material there? It's going to push it right up around the bend. And that one, the left one, squashes the descending colon, pushes the fecal material right down into the sigmoid, which is the staging area for a bowel movement. When this region here gets stretched, that's when you get reflex inhibition of the anal sphincter muscles and that sensation of, uh-oh, I got to go to the toilet. When the children get that look on their face, like, you know, you got about 60 seconds before a disaster hits, right? So if you do not teach people to do full squats, at least with body weight, they are losing one of Mother Nature's primary pump systems to improve physiology, okay? Sure enough, with the advent of the toilet, if you study the literature, if you study the research on Thomas Crapper, who is the man that didn't invent the toilet, but Thomas Crapper was an English plumber who popularized the toilet. He popularized this version of the toilet. All you got to do is go on the internet, in italics, in a search engine, type in Thomas Crapper, and you'll get a pile of information on who popularized the toilet. And if you study medical history, you will see there was a massive increase in constipation right after those toilets. As the toilet became more popular, more and more people got constipated, and there is a tremendous amount of sickness and disease linked to constipation. Okay? So what I've told you so far is that squatting is absolutely essential to the basics of physiology. I always tell my patients, if you can't, you must. It's the things that you can't do that we need to focus on. Most people go to gyms and they do everything that they do well, which just reinforces their weaknesses. Squatting is also extremely important for a process called imbibition. Imbibition is technically the taking up of water by a solid body or gel. What that means is that in your spinal discs, the nucleus and the annulus, when you squat, here you see someone squatting down naturally, it causes a tractioning effect. And then when you load yourself picking up an object, it causes a compression effect. So yesterday, one of the things we talked about was a change of pressure in body compartments, didn't we? And here you can see the porous bone of the vertebral bodies and the discs, and that squatting up and down acts as a pump to feed nutrition to the disc. There is not a blood supply to the discs of the spine. They have to be fed by imbibition, which is loading and unloading of the spine. And functional squatting is a beautiful way to create that pressure variance for hydration. Here you can see pressure fluctuations. Yesterday we talked about the three key pumps of the body. The diaphragm, the deep abdominal wall, and the pelvic floor are your three primary bodily pumps that keep fluids moving through the body. They serve to pump feces, lymph, blood, and they feed and clean the body. So here you can see a typical warehouse worker, construction worker, and I've had my artist put a cutaway, and you can see all the viscous. There's the sigmoid colon. This guy needs to go to the toilet. He's about ready to go. Okay, here you can see all these organs. They're all tubular. There's a certain amount of gas at all times in the intestinal tract. The fermentation of foodstuffs creates gas, which is very important because if you didn't have some level of gas in the intestinal tract, the walls of the intestine would touch each other. And if there was any inflammation, they would stick to each other and scar down, and you would be permanently blocked and you'd probably die unless someone like me that knew what they were doing figured out what was wrong. Okay, and I've had patients have this problem due to trauma to the intestinal tract through the guts, things like martial arts, injuries, auto accidents, etc. But this allows you to visualize the fact that as we're working and breathing and activating our abdominal wall and the pelvic floor, this serves as a beautiful pump system. Now, one of the most effective techniques I've ever used is a concept that I call breathing squats. Now, in weightlifting, they call breathing squats a squat that you can do with a weight that's light enough that you can continue to breathe. So you might do a set of 25 breathing squats. So you just breathe while you do them. But yesterday, I talked to you about activating the parasympathetic nervous system. And I told you there was a key criteria by which you knew you were stimulating the parasympathetic digestive anabolic nervous system. What did I say that was? Come on, it was easy. You got to be able to aid digestion. So if you eat a full meal and you do an exercise, if the intensity is low enough that it facilitates digestion, in other words, you feel like it's helping you digest your food, you are activating the parasympathetic nervous system, which is critical because today most people are heavily sympathetically overloaded. So what you see here in a breathing squat, which is so effective, I'll tell you what recently, sorry, I'm seeing wires that might unplug here. One of my patients recently came to me. He's about 64 years old, very famous athlete. Used to be one of the most famous athletes in the world. Now he weighs 320 pounds, has adult onset diabetes. Came to me, you know, what do I do? I've been following the advice of my doctors and I'm getting worse and worse and worse. So I metabolically typed him, taught him how much water to drink. And he too had arthritic degenerative knees. So I said, okay, here's your entire exercise program. Two or three or four times a day or whenever you feel you can, I want you to, if you've been sitting down for an hour, I want you to get up and do some breathing squats. So all you do is take a comfortable stance, put your arms out here. If that's too tiring, let them hang, take a deep breath. And slow and steady at a rhythmical pace as you go down, breathing through the nose. Natural pause, inhalation on the way up. All you do is you do those breathing squats, exhaling as the body shortens, inhaling as the body lengthens. And if your heart rate speeds up or your respiratory rate speeds up, you're working too hard. So you've got to minimize the effort. So either don't go as deep or try to balance yourself better so it's less effort. He did that for 2 weeks. I saw him at 2.5 weeks. He came back to me and all he had done was change his diet, increase his water intake. And he could only go to a little above halfway before his knees hurt. So I said, fine, that's all you've got to do. And he lost. He went from 220 to 322. He lost 19,301. He lost 19 pounds in 2.5 weeks and never, ever once skipped a meal or went hungry at all. Increasing his water intake improved his physiology. Eating right for his metabolic type. He's a diabetic, so they had him eating piles of carbohydrate, mostly packaged crap. I put him on a whole food diet, predominantly meat and fish based. So his animal intake went up to 70% of his diet. His water intake went up dramatically, and he did breathing squats, and he dropped 19 pounds in 2.5 weeks. Okay. And his energy levels were significantly better. The point is that this breathing squat is a parasympathetic activator. It's what I call a chi cultivator. It helps you harvest chi, which is life force energy. Our exercise programs today, you've got to be very careful because so many of the people coming to the gym, they're already fried. We have got to give them exercise programs that add life to them, not burn them out. Yes. You can exhale through the mouth or the nose. It's just important to breathe in through the nose if you can. I could give you a long lecture on that, but I don't have time. I actually need you guys to hold questions till the end because I got a lot of stuff to tell you. And most of your questions will get answered in the lecture. And at the end, I'll try to answer them if I make it there on time. I got an hour left, I think. So we've been squatting since the beginning of time. And as you see, squatting is a primal movement. We had to squat due to the selective pressures of nature. Everything in your body is based on the selective pressures of nature. First of all, the rules of squatting. If it hurts, don't do it. I never make anybody train through pain. That's an absolute no-no. The only exception to the rule is if I have a patient with a degenerative disorder or a frank orthopedic or neurological dysfunction, and they come to me and they're in pain. For example, many people that see me after having one or more surgeries, I've had people that have had 10, 12, 15 surgeries. Some of these people will never get out of pain because the surgery itself was so damaging to the body that there's permanent damage. people that get nerve injuries, etc. So when someone like that comes to me, I say, okay, what's your pain on a 10 scale? They say, oh, my pain is 7 out of 10. I say, okay, well, we're going to begin our training session today, which is for me is rehabilitation. I'm a holistic health practitioner. I'm not a trainer. Okay. I lecture in this field because I've spent a lot of my life studying this. But people that come to me because they're sick, unhealthy, broken down, can't run, can't jump, and can't move their bowel, etc. So when I'm working with people, I'm working with them to improve something usually. You have to be quite wealthy to want to hire me to train you because I'm not a very cheap date. Okay. So what I say to these people is, okay, if your pain is 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10, we're going to begin our training session. And if at any point during the training it rises above that, you must tell me. Almost always, the pain diminishes with the right type of exercises. When you know how to manipulate the respiratory system, pressure in body cavities, endocrine responses, when you know how to get the breathing right, when you know how to choose the right mechanical load, you activate the proprioceptive systems of the body. The proprioceptive systems travel, the impulses through the proprioceptive neurons travel about 10 times faster than the pain-sensitive nerve endings. So you bombard the spinal cord with movement and proprioception, and the brain can't hear near as much pain. So if you do things right, they almost always have a significant reduction in pain. If they can't, it's our job to find out why they're hurting, why we can't get them to exercise, and we've got to fix it. For you, if you're a trainer and you don't have in-depth skills of analysis, you can go on the internet, find one of my Czech practitioners. They're highly trained people. I've trained, my program's damn tough. I can guarantee you that. There's no slouches in my program. And my program's multidisciplinary. So you got everything from medical doctors to massage therapists in there. It's not just trainers. You can also find a good physio, someone that's got manual therapy training. Find anybody that does a sound assessment of physiology and find out why these people hurt. Don't just descend your exercise program into the basement and have these people doing nothing for the rest of their life, because there's always a reason for pain, and it's our job. If we can't figure it out, we got to find someone that can. You got to be clear about the difference between squatting under heavy load and squatting as an activity of daily living. Just because someone comes to the gym does not mean that they have a date with a Smith machine, okay? You can simply do breathing squats. If you can improve someone's activities of daily living, you're doing a lot for them. We've got to get out of this concept today that the gym is a place to get big, to be buff, you know, to train athletes. Because 90% of the people walking through the door of the gym are polluted on the inside, tired, using drugs. Current research shows that last year in the United States alone, 3 billion drug prescriptions were written. Just to put that in perspective, that's enough drug prescriptions that every man, woman, and child in the U.S. could have a fresh prescription every month. Roughly 85% of all North Americans are on at least one prescribed drug. That would be your clients. So we shouldn't be rushing to kick the hell out of these people, which is the typical approach. Okay, always build people in the order of first improving flexibility and improving muscle balance and stability. Basically, these three things, flexibility, muscle balance, and stability, can be summed up as improving someone's posture, static and dynamic posture, which I talk a lot about in my materials. Once they have normals, flexibility, muscle balance, and stability, this is intrinsic or segmental stability, which I'll talk about in my next lecture. Then we move to strength, and only then do we move to power. Think about that. What would you call your typical high-speed aerobics class? Where would it fall on the scale? 150-something beats a minute? Power. If you complete any movement in less than 1 second, 1001, you're doing a power movement. Okay, think about that. So most of the people coming to the gym are being put into exercise programs, circuit training programs, and so-called functional exercise programs that squarely place them here at the end of the developmental spectrum, which you should never put anybody into until you know they are functional, unless you are a secret agent for the KGB and come to undermine our athletic potential in North America. It's very simple. If you break the rule, you break the client. Now, if you look here, what I want you to understand is that when you are choosing the stance for a squat, it's very, very important that you do not be fixed in the width of the stance. I've seen many bodybuilders in my day trying to get all their clients to squat with their feet parallel and directly below their hips. That is a perfect formula to blow your back out. Okay. Now, if you look here, I've taken this graph from what I believe to be probably the best kinesiology text in the world, which is Kinesiology of the Human Body by Arthur C. Steindler. So what Steindler shows you here is this is the available range of motion of the hip joint in different positions. So if the knee was abducted to there, then you'd see that there would be about that much range of motion. So this shows you the working range of the hip joint. What I want you to see is that the greatest range of motion in the hip is not in the sagittal plane. In women with a wider pelvis, the wider the pelvis, the further into abduction and external rotation the hip has to go. If that hip joint locks up, you will immediately begin rounding your back in the squat. If you are squatting with weights on your back, that is a formula for a herniated disc. Most people today's diets are so bad that their ligaments and their discs are literally made of processed garbage food. You literally are what you eat. This is why I always do a comprehensive 10-day diet analysis on anyone seeing me as a patient, because I want to know what their tissues are made out of before I decide how much stress to put through their body. Okay, so optimal hip range of motion is intimate with hip abduction and external rotation. You have to find the position in which the person can squat. I call it the alley. There's a certain spot when anybody can squat down. Basically, all you've got to do to find that is say, if you were out in the woods and you had to take a dump, how would you do it? And almost anybody goes into their primal instinctual mind and they say, oh, I'd do it just like that. And that looks radically different than the squat stance they've been given by most trainers, because the squat stance that they've just shown you is where they should be. The squat stance that they were using is the one that worked for their trainer. If you look here at Steindler's comparative anatomy, he shows you that in a cross-section of people, you have dramatically different acetabular angles. Some people's femurs are genetically or congenitally internally rotated. Some are externally rotated. Some have a 15-degree femoral neck angle. Some have a 30-degree, a 45-degree, a 60-degree, and some of them are almost straight up and down. You've all seen people that are bow-legged, right, like John Wayne? Well, those people have a dramatically different people than the knock-kneed people, and they're out there too. And if you don't know how to adjust the squat stance for those people, those will be people that will end up running into me and say, oh, I don't squat because it hurts my back. If we were out in the wild, we wouldn't be worried about these things. We'd be more intelligent. We just do what comes natural. You always have to realize that the mechanics of the pelvis, knee, foot, and ankle are linked together. So someone that has a varus femur or bow-legged will also have different foot and knee mechanics and hip mechanics. It's a linked system. If you look down at the top, you can clearly see here that the hip mechanics are linked to foot mechanics. So if somebody has a more externally rotated femur, as you can see in the dotted line here, that would naturally turn their foot out in most cases. So if somebody's feet look abnormally turned out for you, but they say, hey, I can squat good there, they probably have one of these bone structures that's unique. So you can't follow anybody's parameters. What you've got to do is become an expert at identifying the best position for anybody to be in, or you will get hurt when you start adding weight to the body. Now, when it comes to choosing the squat stance, although this is a picture of a deadlift, I'm just using this. This is a clip from my lecture on Sunday, but I want to show you something very important. The only difference between a squat and a deadlift, by the way, is that the center of gravity of your body is pulled down and forward, okay, because the weight's on the floor. So the center of gravity of the body is usually in front of S1. That'll pull your center of gravity down and forward, and it also works the shoulder girdle quite a bit harder. If the bar is across your back, it brings your center of gravity up and back in proportion to the amount of weight on the bar. But what's critical for you to see here is that when your body is in the right squat position, the latissimus dorsi has a working relationship with the opposite gluteus maximus. When those muscles contract in the squat or the deadlift, it actually squeezes the pelvis. So that lat and that glute squeeze the pelvis together, stabilizing the sacroiliac joints. Women have about 6 SI joint disorders for every 1 male. Okay, so 6 women to 1 man, because the hormonal fluctuations influence ligamentous tension and stability. There are estrogen receptors in most ligaments in the human body. So any female with high levels of estrogen runs the risk of having ligament laxity. So the first thing you've got to do is you've got to activate the deep abdominal wall, which is synonymous with the intrinsic stabilizers of the body, the multifidus, the TVA, the internal oblique, the pelvic floor, the diaphragm. But if you look here, this activates what is called the nutcracker effect. When the belly button comes in, it pulls the 2 halves of the ilium together. Because the ligaments there don't stretch, when the transverse abdominis fires and the belly button moves inward, each half of the ilium moves toward the other, boom, like that. That squeezes the sacrum in the middle, stabilizing it. As soon as somebody's squat stance comes too narrow, they lose the mechanical advantage of the large gluteus maximus muscles, because the femur rotates inwardly, so they don't have optimal alignment. When the stance is right, you'll see there's almost a perfect alignment between the femur and the angle of the SI joint. So the SI joint sits on an oblique angle. So if this is the plane of the sacroiliac joint, so there's the body of the sacrum, there's the joint, and here's the ilium. You with me? Okay. So if my femur is in the right position, if that's the plane of the SI joint, what you'll find is most people feel best when their legs are in the plane of the SI joint, because that's the point at which, when the lats and the gluteus maximus contract, it perfectly stabilizes the SI joint. So the instant you start turning the feet inward or bringing the legs inward to favor somebody else's idea, you potentially destabilize the low back and the SI joint. Okay, so we've got to be conscious of these things. Now, when it comes to choosing a lumbar lift position, there are some concerns. You always have to look at their history of injury. If they've ever had a disc injury, they're a high-risk patient. If you don't know, ask them if they've ever had pain in the low back that radiated to the hip, knee, ankle, or foot. Almost always, that is a disc injury. There's other things that can do that, but you're safe to assume that's a disc injury. If they had pain with prolonged periods of sitting, for example, if they drove their car a half an hour and it was hard to straighten up after getting out of the car, that's a prominent disc sign. If their pain is worse in the morning, that's a disc sign. If they say, boy, my back hurts like hell in the morning, I got to walk around for a while and it starts to feel better, that's a disc sign, because overnight the disc rehydrates itself and the disc swells and that irritates the injured tissue. Kind of like if you've ever had a cracked lip and you smile, well, when they get up in the morning and they load that rehydrated disc, it fractures all the fresh scar tissue the body laid down at night. Another a disc injury. So if you get somebody that works like in a daycare center or a nurse, and they have to keep bending over to pick things up, and they say, my back gets worse and worse, that's a disc injury. Those people you've got to be extremely careful with when they do the squat, not to let them go into flexion in the lumbar spine, or you will exacerbate a disc injury. If you have someone that you think's high risk, you need someone that's trained to handle these things to help you out. Don't give up on them. Don't do anything silly. The way you learn is you find someone that knows more than you and you learn from them. That's how I got here. We must remember, though, that if somebody does not have a history of disc injury, or if they have a history of disc injury, but it's completely rehabilitated, and it's safe to add flexion to that spine, we must remember that the ligaments need exercise too. In my chapter, Posture and Craniofacial Pain, that I wrote in a book, Chiropractic Approach to Head Pain, Williams and Wilkins, 1994, I quoted anatomy professor McCotter, who showed through research studies that ligaments hypertrophy. He showed that when you exercise ankle joints, like if you cut open the ankle of a professional soccer player, you will see that they have much thicker and larger ankle ligaments than sedentary people. Most athletes do. The ligaments will hypertrophy. So one of the things that we've got to understand, we're not just training muscles, we're also training ligaments. And if you don't use it, you lose it. Okay? If someone is at risk for a disc injury, I teach my students in level 1 of my training program how to manage common spinal pathologies. You can't see it real well here, but there is very sticky orthopedic taping tape holding that spine in neutral, and they're only allowed to squat to the point they feel the tape begin to pull. The tape serves as a biofeedback mechanism to tell them, hey, you're losing your lordosis, which keeps the disc centralized, okay? You must use range of motion control. Here you see I've set the pins in the cage, so it's impossible for her to put her basket back at risk. Another common problem is that a lot of people teaching the squat tell people, oh, you've got to stick your butt out like Donald Duck. You ever seen that? Yes? Is anyone here? Huh? Unfortunately, yes. Well, if you understand the basic anatomy of the spine, you got one disc and two facet joints at each level. The facet joints are the little bony structures in the back of the spine. I'm sure you've all seen them, right where the nerves come out. The foramina, where the nerve comes out, the top of the foramina is made of this superior articular facet, and the bottom of the foramina is the inferior articular facet. Those two bones go together and the nerve comes out between them. In the lumbar spine, those things, according to Compagni and White's book on spinal mechanics, are only designed to hold 8% of the load at any given spinal segment. The other, what is it, 8 negative 16, the other percentage, 8 for each facet, the rest of it should go through the disc, which is a much, much larger structure. So if you have somebody excessively lordose their spine, when you go to do a squat, there's a massive contraction of the back muscles, which will jam those facets together. Only with box stock beginners do I have them accentuate the lordosis just to train it into their mind to hold that position. But I'm usually using wimpy little weights in a training phase like that. As the person learns to squat, I want them to breathe in, activate the abdominal wall, and hold spinal neutral. And then the more advanced squatters, I let them heavy squat heavy enough that they're pulled into a straight spine. The problem is if you hold that spine in lordosis under load, it jams the facet joints together. That causes inflammation. As soon as you inflame a facet joint, you get reflex inhibition of the stabilizer muscles of the trunk. So all of a sudden, you see the stabilizer muscles start to shut off because pain always causes inhibition. And each segment of each disc and each facet joint is innervated by the sinovertebral or recurrent meningeal nerve, which communicates directly through the sympathetics and through the afferent system to the muscles at that level. So each joint of the spine communicates with the muscles crossing that joint. You understand that? Davis's law, Hilton's law says the nerve that innervates the joint innervates the muscles of the joint and the skin over the origins and insertions of such muscles. Hilton's law. One of the most important things you can do for anybody that has degenerative disc disease or degenerative joint disease, which is going to be a lot of your clients at 40 years of age or more, is not only to strengthen them and use pumping exercises, but you've got to get their body hydrated. These tissues have to be hydrated. One of the places the body goes to scavenge water to feed the central nervous system is the discs and the joints, the cartilage of the body, which are about 95 to 98% water, okay? So your average person needs to be drinking about half their body weight in ounces of water a day. Okay, take your body weight. 200-pound man needs 100 ounces of water a day.